thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
I think the first thing I wanted to talk about is like the education system revamps. I think in your years with the ministry, you've rolled out announced a couple of them. So after becoming education minister, right, what was your most urgent priority and why? You know, there are lots of education policies and things to change and levers that you can touch, right? Which one did you point at and say, like, okay, let's work on this first?
Okay, I must correct one misperception that when I became the education minister, then there were this list of things that I wanted to do. There were these things that I wanted to do. So in MOE, we don't work like that. And this is perhaps one of our strengths. Education is what I call a long cycle business. You never really know the results and outcome until many years later. And therefore, we shouldn't judge our outcomes based on the here and now. So I always encourage my teachers, I say, no, our KPI, if you like, is not just the scores that the students get here and now, but more importantly, it's not what they do in the first 15 years of their life when they are with us, but what they do in the next 50 years of their life when they are no longer with us. Do they continue to learn? Do they have the joy of learning? Do they want to keep discovering new things, making new connections? That's our real success. So if we look at that perspective, then there's a certain trajectory or arc that we have in our education system that we have done over the years, and we are just continuing to improve as we go along this arc. So there's not a sharp turn or a discontinuity. Yeah. So to give an example, more concrete example, when we look at full subject-based banding, we have done this for a while, and now we have to roll it out on a wider scale. But full subject-based banding is actually built on the previous system, which people generally call streaming. But why did streaming start, and what is the similarity between full subject-based banding and streaming? In the past, our students' dropout rate could be as high as 40%. And that's because in many public education systems, we have this challenge of teaching to the average, where a class of 30, 40 students of such diverse abilities, we can only have one way of teaching, which then means that we teach to the average, which means that half of the class will probably find it too boring, half of the class will probably find it too difficult. Then how do we customize the teaching according to the learning needs of our students? And that's why streaming, notwithstanding the negative comments about stigma, is actually a much more efficient way to apply our resources and also much more effective in the teaching and learning of the students, because now they can be grouped into students of different abilities and we can customize the teaching according to their needs. But of course, we know there is a downside which people call stigmatization, but there is also another downside in the previous streaming, which is we look at the average of a student's ability, where generally, I take the average of all your languages and your math and science, and we say that you are at this level. And we know that students have diverse abilities. Some people might be good at math and science and not so good at languages. So we challenge ourselves and ask ourselves, can we customize even further, not just in terms of your general abilities, but to the specific abilities in different subjects, different domains? And that is why we built on the streaming to go further into full subject-based banding, which is, in some sense, a sort of streaming, but according to your different abilities in different domains. And that allows students with different abilities to have the confidence to say that I may be good at this, I may not necessarily be good at other things, and I don't need to be good at everything. I can pursue what I'm good at, and I keep working on it. And for those subjects that are weaker, I don't need to be put in a class where it's probably not appropriate for my abilities. So you can see in education policies in Singapore, we have this very unique system because of the continuity of the government to build on the previous foundations that we have laid.
So I think talking about full subject-based banding, obviously there are some obvious benefits with which you've already touched on, the mixing between kids in class and of course allowing kids to take subjects at a higher level if they're good at it, and then they don't have to struggle, I think, with higher level subjects
according to their respective needs.
Precisely. But so what are some of the more less obvious benefits of full subject-based banding?
Well, I think there is a larger cultural shift that we want to achieve from full subject-based banding, and that is respect. Respect for each other's diverse capabilities, rather than to pigeonhole people by a very simple matrix. You are good, you are no good. I think we are all good at something, we are all not so good at certain other things. And every different child has a different profile, different gifts, different abilities. And we want people to have that diversity of strengths. We want people to respect the diversity of abilities. And that, I think, in time to come, will make our society a much more inclusive, much more heartwarming society, because we appreciate people for what they have rather than to, if you like, pigeonhole people into broad categories that doesn't help us to appreciate their diverse strengths. And then it gives confidence to the people with the diverse strengths to say that I can always make a contribution. Even if I'm poor, it doesn't mean that I'm helpless. Even if I'm not good at math, it doesn't mean that I'm not good at everything and everything else. It just means that I must play to my strength, and I want all our students to understand their strengths and weaknesses. So I have one favorite question that I always ask my school children when I meet them. I say that regardless of your grades, I want to know, do you know what makes you special? I want every child to know that they have something special in them and they can use whatever that they have been gifted with to make a contribution to society.
Mm-hmm. Just now, I think you mentioned a part of long-term policy is knowing how to... It's not immediate outcomes, right? So this outcome of respecting diversity and helping all the kids play to their strengths, I think is a good way to put it. Is that an outcome that this policy intended for? And what in the past led to this decision?
It started with a story whereby we try to customize, but we also want to make the customizations more fine-grained. And that is why we keep seeking to improve on our system. Maybe I take a step back and I share with you what I always say is the challenge of any public education system. In any conventional public education system throughout history across the world has what I call this trilemma. How do you achieve quality? How do you at scale? How do you achieve speed of innovation, relevance, and yet affordability? Conventional education system across the world and across history, if you have quality and you are fast, chances are that it's going to be expensive, which means that it's not likely to be scalable. If you are fast and you are affordable, chances are the quality not so good. And if you have quality and you are affordable, chances are that you can't scale. So there has always been a dilemma or trilemma in education system. And as parents and as teachers, we all want to be able to customize according to needs of our child. So when we say a simple thing, to bring out the best in every child, it's easy to say, but not so easy to do. Because to bring out the best in every child, we truly need to understand the strengths of every child, and then to build on those strengths and to have a learning program according to his or her unique needs. Then the question we challenge ourselves is, can we break this trilemma? And if so, how? It's just like a lot of people talk about reducing class size. I always challenge ourselves, why just reduce class size? Can you reduce class size to a class size of one, whereby the curriculum is so customized to the individual? Now that sounds like the holy grail of an education system, right? To achieve quality at scale, speed and affordability. But today, better than any time in history, we have a chance to do that. And we are moving in that direction to mass customize. Because today, with technology, data science, and even AI, we can better customize according to the needs of every child. We can take a leaf from how the gaming world is doing this. When they do gamification, everybody plays game to the level. And you keep practicing at that level until you move on to the next level. Same concept. We ask ourselves, can this be applied to the education system? And the answer is yes. And if we can do that, then we can use our finite resources to really cater our teaching resources and time to the high-need students to help them to achieve things that the computers and the AI can do. So I give some tangible examples. Today, if we do math, there's no point teaching to the average of the whole class. Some students are better, some students are weaker. But when you allow them to interact with the computers and the computers can generate problem sums for them according to different standards and ability, then you are almost like playing a game and you go according to your respective abilities. Even something for languages, as simple as learning to pronounce words or learning to read a passage, there are commercially available programs already in the market that allows you to read a passage, give you feedback on your pronunciation, test your understandings, and then come up with a new passage to try to stretch you a bit to the next level. So if you like, these are what we call mass customizations. In the past, we have applied some of these technologies to our special needs students, but actually the same technology can be applied across to many other students. So we think that today, better than any time in history, we have the chance to mass customize according to the needs of our students. Then we break this paradigm and move away from this thing about class size. Today, we already have varying class sizes. The higher needs students have smaller class sizes, whereas those who are much more independent can adopt some of this technology. But I want to add a word of caution. MOE is not about to deploy technology universally, because different students take to technology differently. Back of envelope, rough rule of thumb, we know that the high-ability students will adapt to technology much faster, and the technology will be able to help them to stretch more. The high-need students, we don't always start with high-tech. We start with what we call high-touch. We need to build the relationship for them to have a stable environment, for them to trust the people who are interacting with them before we talk about the high-tech. Now, with more load being able to be complemented by this technological resources to complement our teaching resources, then we can apply our teaching time and resources to really focus on the higher needs students, not just higher needs in terms of academics, but could be higher needs in terms of their social-emotional development.
Minister, sorry, can I just quickly go back to full subject-based mandate before we move off? I'm sure MOE tracks the outcome of educational policies. At this point in time, you know, are there any, is it too early to tell the outcome, or are there things that we are seeing that shows that we are in the right direction?
There are already things that we are seeing. First, we are seeing that people mix around much more. They have a wider group of friends of different abilities, and they are starting to respect the diversity of strengths, the diversity of abilities, and I think that makes for a much more inclusive society. So that's one. The second thing is that many more students are now able to say that if I'm good at this subject and I want to take it at a higher level, I have the opportunity to do so, so I can strive. So if I want to go from G2 to G3, I can do so. But we have to be careful. We don't want a situation whereby the parents keep telling the kid that you must always strive for the G3, regardless of your interests and abilities. We want to work with parents to say that we must understand the strengths and weaknesses and the interests and passion of our children so that we put them in the appropriate classes. So we are seeing this. But to answer your question fully, it does mean that it takes up more resources from MOE because it's a huge logistic exercise to try to mass customize, having people go to different classes according to their abilities. So that is the part that we are committed to do for our children. And then we will also need some children to be much more independent, because this model of learning is closer to what we do in JCs and universities, where you might have gaps in the days, whereby not all your classes are back-to-back. There are pros and cons of it. The pros that you take a break, you do some self-initiated learning, or you go and do your own thing, or you just take a break. But some people will think that, why do you have gaps in schools, and then what do they do in between, right? So actually, it is also an opportunity for us to inculcate in our students this self-directed learning, because if we go back to the 15 years versus the 50 years, what we want to see is our students' ability and zest to learn on their own without somebody hovering over them and telling them what to do. So I always like to ask my student this question. I say that, tell me something that you have learned on your own that your teacher never taught you and your parents never asked you to go for classes. Because it really shows whether the students have this innate desire to learn. And when we do full SBB, you have greater variety of programming. It also gives the students the confidence to say that I can pursue my interest areas which may not be the conventional or mainstream. And I think we are seeing some green shoots of such attitude, but we are under no illusion that it's a long journey for us to get into this culture as a society, to respect the diversity of strengths and to play to our strengths, and to move away, very importantly, to move away from this relativist mindset, which means that I look at myself, not whether I'm doing well or not, but I look at myself whether I'm doing well with respect to others, because that can be quite demoralizing. Actually, many of our students are very good. I mean, just to sidetrack, if you look at our PISA score or you look at our trends in mathematics and science scores, 80% of our students are above the global average. There is absolutely no reason why our students should feel down or out. But if we keep making our students compare themselves with one another, then in this relativist mindset, there's always a winner and loser. Our real relativity is not between our own students in our own system. Many of them are above the global average. But our real relativity is how do we, as a system, how do we, on average, our students, perform with the rest of the world. And we need to keep moving that along.
So you mentioned like things like intangible traits like attitudes, desire to learn. Do you expect this to translate into academic results? Like, is it an expected outcome or is something that, you know?
I think it is not just about academic results. There's another thing that MOE is doing now is what we call learn more, test less. So when we say academic results, there are two parts to it. One is just academic. We want to go beyond academics where people have a diversity of strengths, including academics. Not that academics is not important, but also other strengths, life skills, soft skills, the ability to connect. Because in a more fragmented world, the ability to connect, the ability to build bridges, the ability to create something new and not just answer yesterday's question with yesterday's answer. These are important skill sets for us to have. So I think, so it's just beyond academic. And the other one is beyond results. You see, there's this saying that not everything important in life can be measured, and we don't want to just make important what we can measure. So we must be careful when we say we measure. When we measure, if we do it positively, it can spur people to the next level. But if we measure and we keep thinking of this as a sorting mechanism to compare ourselves relative to others, then it can be quite negative. So when we say results, actually we want to move beyond this thing about comparing ourselves with one another. The results is not for comparison. The results is more for us to better understand ourselves so that in the next step of our learning journey, we are sited in a more appropriate environment. Not an environment whereby we are the smallest fish in the shark pond, whereby we are struggling to keep up, or the other way, where I am just the bored person in class because I have already known all this and my level is different. So I think right-siting the student in the next step of his or her learning journey is the most important outcome of that results rather than relativist comparison.
Just now you mentioned the trilemma, quality, skill, speed, affordability, right? So you also said FSBB is obviously a large logistical exercise. I think teachers on the ground will agree with that. Which area do you think we still need to work on?
Which area?
Of the trilemma. What do you think is the immediate?
No, in fact, we are trying to break the whole trilemma by having this mass customization. Because if I can mass customize, then I can... Today, you look at the technology. In the past, it would be fair to say every education system depends on quality teachers. Today, the education system still need to depend on quality teacher. But today we can scale quality at a much more affordable price and a much faster pace. So for example, today, even just going onto the YouTube, you have many good teaching resources made available across. So even within the MOE system, we have our own internal system where our teachers will share their teaching resources. So instead of trying to reinvent the wheel and try and find clever ways to interest students of different abilities, actually we have our own resource our own intranet, it's Opal, so that they can figure out what are some of the things that they can adapt for themselves. So with that, we can break the trilemma of quality, speed, and affordability, right? So when we start to customize for the students, again, we try to break that trilemma. So we can't tackle the trilemma like in the past, bit by bit. But today, with AI, with technology, with data and data science, we can do very customized teaching. Maybe I should give you an example. Singapore Polytechnic. Today, they don't know what to do with their lecture theatres. Because in the past, people go to a lecture, then you know in a lecture, some people get bored, some people be struggling as usual. Today in Singapore Polytechnic, and they have tried this way before COVID, they have put their lessons online. You access the modules, as they say, own time, own target. But that's not all. Very interestingly, over time, they figure out that when the students access the modules, they know which part of the module the students need more help. How do they know that? They started by having pop quizzes. So they know, okay, maybe this part the students didn't answer so well, we need a bit more help. But over time, they have even used data analytics in a very interesting way. They look at the speed at which the students access the modules. Some parts of the module, the students double up the speed, which probably suggests that it's either boring or too easy. Some parts of the module, the students keep rewinding and repeating. Maybe that ones need a bit more explanation. So when the students come back, whether it's in Singapore Poly or even in SUSS, the lecturers are able to intervene in a very surgical way to say that let's spend a bit more time on this rather than what we call that one size fit all. And they can customize it according to the class. Now, this is just one example of the power of technology and data analytics of how we can focus the teaching of content. But having said that, there's some other things that you can't use the technology to do that. Relationship building and all that kind of things, you cannot just use the technology. So this is just an example of how we try to break that trilemma of achieving quality at scale, speed and affordability.
But you wouldn't go so far as to say that we've broken it.
It is a continuous journey. I think today we have the elements to know how to maybe not break it totally, but certainly to overcome some of the conventional constraints. And I think we'll keep pushing along this way. In fact, just now I was at in Newtown Primary here. I saw them doing English essay writing. Commercially available program. The teacher gave them an essay to write. They wrote the essay. Immediately, each of them get a personalized feedback on how the essay could have been, the passage could have been improved. Now, this is something that would have been very time-consuming in the past whereby the teacher have to mark each paper and things like that. But that doesn't mean that the teacher is no longer required. The teacher is still required because the teacher needs to know the student's general abilities to then be able to see how much technology we should apply to complement the teaching. For some of the high-need students, you don't even do that for a start. But then we also know that technology is not foolproof. So the teachers will also check. Another example would be some of the students, they wanted to say, oh, why don't we use ChatGPT to write essays? In fact, one of the schools, or at least one of the schools that I know, actually told the students, go and use ChatGPT and other programs to write the essay. Then we all come back and we critique the essays. So you bring the teaching and learning to the next higher level. It's not just learning how to use AI, but how do you critique and know the strength, weaknesses, and pitfalls of using such a programs. They even compare how their baseline essay, when run through different AI programs, come up with different variations. How do you detect plagiarism? How do you know to pick which version for your purposes? So I think there's tremendous potential for us to apply technology to alleviate the workload of our teachers and at the same time to improve the quality of our teaching and learning.
Okay. So just now you talked a bit about the sorting system, right, and how we kind of want to move away from that. So, you know, one of the sorting systems we have in Singapore is the PSLE. Were there any arguments against changing the PSLE scoring system?
Okay. There will always
Was it difficult to convince everyone, I think, that it was necessary?
I always say this, that, you know, any policy changes that you have, the first thing I'll say is that there'll be many people with different ideas, right? But we need to be true to our core principles and considerations. Now, you look at the old PSLE T-score system, and even the T-score system, we have evolved it quite. I think during my time, the PSLE scoring system go up to the 400 series. Okay, you're probably too young to know. Maybe you will know, right?
Yeah.
I think the top score was 400. That was at one time, right? Then we went to the 200 series, right? Then we went there. But you look at it, the question we asked ourselves in that particular change was this. Is there a need for us to compete until the, what I call the second decimal point, at such a young age? Or are we better at just broad bending? Because even for O levels and A levels, we do bending. Then we ask ourselves, is it necessary? And I think from a pedagogical and education perspective across the world, people would say that there's no need for us to do such fine bending. But is there a need for us to do some bending? And the answer from the pedagogical side and the education world is yes. Because if you don't bend and you pretend to teach everybody the same thing for another 4 years, actually it's not so effective and at times could be detrimental to their learning. So how do you balance between some sorting in order for the teaching and learning to be more effective without the excessive stress of this very fine-grained bending? And that's why we arrive at this solution whereby it's a bending a bit like your O-level, A-level at a younger age. But once we say this, then there's another set of parents that says that, no, this is not fair because my son scored 71, his son scored 74, and then if they are in the same band, this is totally not fair because it's a difference of 3 points, right? But that comes to another point, which is that we can change systems, structure, processes, but we must always couple that with a change in the culture and the mindset. If we don't change our culture and mindset, then it will defeat all this. So just taking the AL scoring system, now it's not so fine, right? Then people say, but I want to be very fine in my posting results. When I'm competing for that one popular school, I want it to be very fine-grained. But if we say that, then we go back to where we started with. Then do you want to have a very stressful, fine-grained system? And if the mindset doesn't change, then people will start to say that, oh, then this is not good enough to differentiate at such a young age. I want greater differentiation. So we have to ask ourselves, if you want greater differentiation, do you want the greater stress that comes with it? And then people might try and say that, okay, now I'll try and differentiate myself in other ways in order to, if you like, beat your system or add on to your system. So to me, it goes back to where you started off. We can change policies, we can change structures, and so on and so forth. But we must always remember that you must keep pace with the cultural change, because if you don't do that, then you'll be defeated by the best of our intention. Another example would be the GEP program that we have made modifications in the past. In the past, it was two exams or two tests, and then you decide at P3 whether you want to go on to this program, you can go on to this program. But we have very good rationale and say that, well, people develop at different stages. There should be multiple entry and exit points depending on your interests. All with good intentions. And we don't want this hot housing before the exam, because some of the students who get into this program through the hot housing actually do themselves a lot of harm. And their whole learning journey is disrupted. Right? But guess what? If we don't change our mindset, some tuition center will immediately go and advertise, oh, last time you only need to prepare up to P3, but now don't worry. MOE says that you can go in P4, you can go in P5, so you should continue to come and send your child to such what I call hot housing classes. Then I think we defeat the purpose and intent, even with the best of intention. That's why I must always go back to this thing. Structure, organization, processes must change in tandem with a mindset and cultural shift. For us to really believe that if we want to bring out the best in our children, is to let them develop at their own pace, stretch them according to their needs, but stop comparing them always and unnecessarily with other people who develop at other pace, other speed.
Okay. I think it's interesting because the two examples that you raised, right, is kind of the policy intent, as with many that were rolled out in the past few years, is to reduce the fixation on grades, reduce academic stress. But then parents, are, maybe not parents, even students themselves, right, they also find other ways to... The stress just becomes another form. You know, where PSL is concerned, they find other ways to differentiate them. Then maybe they focus more on things like DSA, or they're scared that their CCA doesn't make it, right? So actually, would you say that there's evidence of success that the policies are actually reducing stress in schools? Or
okay, yeah. So again, I want to caveat by saying that reduction of stress is not our only or primary goal, right? Because no stress doesn't mean that it is necessary, most suitable for the child. Actually, different children have different stress tolerance and different abilities. Our job is to help them overcome the stress and over time to slowly become more confident. And not so much to take away the stress from them or not to take away the ability to resolve the problem from them. Because sometimes, I think as Singaporeans and as parents, we are very eager to, maybe sometimes too eager to take away the obstacles or take away the what we call stress from the children without appreciating that sometimes they need some of this in order to grow. So that's why in MOE, we say that in the past, we always say there's a duty of care. But going forward, we say we must balance the duty of care with the duty to grow. Because duty of care doesn't mean I bubble wrap the child and provide for everything and structure him for everything in order for him to perform. It is one thing for our children to perform because they are provided in a very structured and protected environment. It's another thing for them to perform when the environment is not as structured and not so much is provided for. And that is the real test beyond school. So how do we make this transition into an environment whereby our children are much more independent, confident and resilient? So sometimes we need to let go of this in order for our children to grow. So I always visit the secondary schools, and one of the things that I like to check them is this. Whenever they have school camps, I always ask them, show me your school camp program. And it's very normal for all our school camps to have this. 6 o'clock, you wake up, 7 o'clock, you brush teeth, 8 o'clock, you eat breakfast. I mean, jokes aside, you literally structured everything for them. And I think the students enjoyed it because they play. Then I always encourage and challenge them. I say, would you take out a few hours, an afternoon, a morning, and just let the students plan their own program? Because my hypothesis, and I think have been validated by many parents and educators, is that when people do things on their own, they own it more, they become more confident, and even if they make mistakes, they learn from it. This is what they call scientifically the IKEA effect. People like IKEA furniture not just because of the quality and the price and so forth, but because there's a sense of participation in doing it. And I think going forward, we need to give our children more opportunities to demonstrate that sense of participation, that sense of ownership. Then they feel that I have the sense of agency to do what I want to do, rather than just performing to standard because it has been structured so for them, right? So we must not mistake performance in the near term with that sense of the greater sense of agency, responsibility and ownership in the long term.
When you talk about mindsets and culture change, I mean, you are going up against a multi-billion dollar tuition industry. I mean, anecdotally, whenever MOE, and you mentioned it yourself, you know, have introduced a new policy, the industry is very quick to react and cry on, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, good for them, being very enterprising. But is there anything that we can do or is a losing battle?
No, I don't think it's a losing battle. I think more and more parents, even though it may not change overnight, are beginning to appreciate that all our children, they are all different. They all need different support systems. We don't need to keep comparing them always with somebody else. And I think that message, now we have, almost all our schools have the parent support group. In fact, I just met them last Saturday. I think the feedback is coming through. And through the parent support group, we are also trying to get the message out. Because sometimes when MOE says something, then it's like, no, you are the authority, right? But when fellow parents tell fellow parents, then I think it's a different vibe and the message is different. Of course, there's this tension, right? Like you say, in any parents chat group, there are two set of forces trying to tussle with one another. You have parents chat group that, oh, have you gone for this tuition? And unfortunately, these people, sometimes they just try to guilt trip other people and set in motion this, what we call FOMO, the fear of missing out phenomena. But I think more and more so, you also see parents that go into the same chat group and say, hey guys, let's take a, let's pause and let's think whether this is necessary for our children and whether it's best. And I think over time, you will find more and more of this balancing voice. But on Chee Kong's point, I think it goes beyond just what MOE and parents do. I think, and I have been speaking to many of the industry leaders, that they also have a part to play in this whole of society effort to appreciate the diversity of strengths. I always jokingly ask all the HR manager, I say, you know, when you have so many applicants with you with so sterling results, how do you choose your potential employee? Well, the easy way is to take the results and just the academic results, never mind even the non-academic attributes, and say that I do this, because chances are that nobody will question you, because it's the yardstick. There's certain clarity in the yardsticks. But many HR managers will also tell me that, you know, if I take in somebody who may not be the top scorers in this, then my boss will ask me, why did I take that? Yeah, it takes a bit more effort, but will you do that? But so these are also signals which parents and students are getting. So if our society, if our industries do not appreciate the diversity of skills, then I think we will be fighting even the uphill battle is even tougher. But we have also seen more progressive companies now. Some I shall name, yes, in this program, I shall not name any particular company, but there are many companies, including multinationals, that say that, okay, you, the two of you, you want to apply for a job, this is a problem. And they put you together and solve a problem. And they don't care what's your background so much. They know roughly what's your background. Then they say, they want to look at your problem-solving skills. They want to look at how the two of you work together with one another, assuming that you don't know one another beforehand from different backgrounds. And these are important skill sets. And the problem that they let you so-called solve, chances are that it doesn't really have a solution yet. So they want to look at your ability to create new solutions. They look at your abilities to connect across cultures, across different backgrounds. So I think these are skill sets which more companies are now becoming more aware of beyond just the academic grades. In fact, there's a joke going around that if you take in a Singapore student, the last thing you need to check is his academic grades, because generally they are all right. Okay, maybe I should say they're more than all right, because 80-90% are above the global average. So people are not looking at that from the Singapore students. They pretty much assume that generally you're all right, right? Plus, minus a bit, okay. But these other intangible skills, the ability to create, the ability to connect, the ability to contribute, those are things that I think will distinguish us compared to the people who just present themselves with a good academic record.
On the tuition industry, I mean, is regulation ever an option? I mean, some countries have tried it.
And we have watched these experiments by some of these countries, and sad to say, actually, they didn't always work as intended. In fact, it has just gone underground. In fact, it has caused a bifurcation between the haves and the have-nots even more, because the haves will have all kinds of private tuition where the auntie will come to the house and pretend to be an auntie, and then the rest will have. Actually, to be honest, whenever I talk to the students and ask them about tuition, I usually ask them a few questions. I ask them, did you ask to go for the extra tuition, or did someone else send you for the extra tuition? Now, that's a very fundamental difference. If the students say that I want to strive, actually, I don't very much have a problem with that if they want to learn more. But I'm always worried for the students who look very grouchy and down when they go for such lessons, because they seem to be trying to fulfill someone else's expectations rather than their own aspirations. So I think we need to make a difference. We can push our kid so much, but if our kid doesn't have the innate desire to want to improve, then you only go so far. Then the day they leave the school, the day they are no longer under our watchful eyes, they will stop learning. So this is the first question. Then I have another problem with some tuition centres which I think are really black sheeps of the industry. One, those people who tout their services. They guilt trip the parents to think that, you know, so many people are doing this. Why are you not doing this? It's a bit like the milk powder problem we have a few years back, right? There's no way to regulate this, but it's a cultural mindset, is to give our parents a confidence that I know my child best and I don't need to be subjected to all these things out here. So that day I was quite upset where P1, first day of school, one of these tuition centre stood outside one of my school and gave out flyers So my principal went out and gave them a piece of our mind. It's totally unnecessary. P1, there's no exams. Instead of inculcating the joy of learning, you're handing out flyers to the parents to create this fear of missing out. So this is one problem. I have another problem with some of the tuition centres, and that is that they pre-select the students and then they claim credit. And I think it's most unethical, and I think it does a disservice to the whole image of a teacher. And I don't like people who use their students to advertise their services when they might, from what we know, given so-called a discount or enticement to the students. I think all these are unnecessary, and it just adds to the guilt-tripping of the parents, and it's really a disservice. To me, all my teachers in MOE, they understand my expectations. We serve everyone regardless of background. In fact, we take care of those with the higher needs even more. It is not right for people to come and say that I pre-select the students and try to claim credit. Then what is your real value add? All right? It's like some people try to get top PSLE students to endorse their product, and we know which are the guilty ones. You say, oh, if you consume this product, you will get top PSLE score. Sorry, it's the other way around. They got top PSLE score, and you ask them to endorse your product. That is not correct. So can we regulate this? We are talking to the advertising industry to see whether we can have a code of conduct, if you like, on what is right to do and what is wrong to do. For the sake of the own industry, the advertising industry, because you just give a bad name to the whole industry if we allow this to fester. And I think, on the other hand, on the positive side, we are pushing out more resources, making available more resources to the students and the parents. Because I want every child and every parent in Singapore to know, we have an education system that do not depend on your means. You'll be very sad for us one day if our education is one whereby the resources and opportunities are allocated according to means and not needs. I always say, I don't come from a privileged family. If someone like me can be brought up by the system, I want to make sure that every generation, someone like me, can make a positive contribution and realize their full potential. And that must be a collective effort. And we shouldn't have this mindset that I can only succeed in Singapore because I have the means. Or I cannot succeed in Singapore, on the other hand, I cannot succeed in Singapore because I don't have the means of others. And if you look at our PISA score, it affirms what we are trying to do. People say that we have a big gap in our PISA scores. But actually, our big gap is not because our poorer students are not doing well. Our poorer students, compared to their peers, are above people's average. Above people's average, not just beating their own group of students, same kind of background. They are above the global average. Why should we make our people feel inadequate? Why should we do so? We do a disservice to ourselves. That's why if we are comparing ourselves, we are not comparing ourselves internally. The competition is not within Singapore. The competition is how Team Singapore compare with the rest of the world. And this is something that we have just have to keep working on it. It's a never-ending challenge to see how we can make sure that the positive messages are going out. So we look at the SLS system today, the internet system, yeah. Our learning space, the Singapore learning space. Actually, all our students, if they log on to the SLS, they have all the best teaching resources across all the schools. There's no need to go and spend money to go and buy extra test papers as we may have need to do in the past. They have modules that they can even access if they are so interested, even at levels beyond the school. I went to one school, a Sec 3 student was saying that during his holidays he was looking at Sec 4 classes. I said, why do you do that? He said, oh, well, it's all available, right? He knows how to. And our parents need to know that such resources are made available. But of course, there was a joke amongst the parent support group. It says, should you let the parents know that actually your child, once it's in the MOE school system, have access to all these resources? Say, well, the positive thing is that then the child might be inspired to go and learn at their own pace. He said, well, but then you might have end up with some kiasu parents that will cause the child to go and do everything in there, regardless of the child's need. So I think it's not just making available what we can to the quality resources, that the part we talk about scaling, the quality resources to everyone, but also to work with our parents to apply those resources according to the needs and abilities of our children, rather than say, oh, all these are available. MOE certainly don't expect you to finish, and you certainly cannot finish everything that's inside the SLS, and that's not the aim. But we want our children to say that, hey, if there are so many things to learn in the SLS, even if it's not done in my classroom, can I go and learn something on my own? And that, I think, is really the real essence of learning.
If we are talking about unreasonable expectations, I also want to talk about, you know, the part of teachers. Like, I think you addressed it recently also at the conference last September. But of course, you know, expectations on teachers, it goes beyond like the work-related messages that they receive late at night. You know, parents, I think parents these days generally have higher expectations of teachers. You know, they want, I wouldn't say back and call, but, you know, they really want someone who's there and supporting their child. They want to know, I think they want to know that the teacher is there and always supporting their kid. So, you know, how does this changing dynamic between the parent and teachers and balancing what's at home and in school, how does that take a toll on teachers?
Actually, the role of the teachers and the parents have evolved over time. I mean, if I may just share a simple story or anecdote. Many years ago, I think in our generation, my mother's joke was that if I have to turn up in school, you are in trouble, right? Because don't expect to create trouble for the teachers, right? So I think, and maybe because of the difference in the education level between, say, my mother and the teachers, I think there's a great respect and there's a great trust. I remember I fell down in primary one. I just tripped and fell down, and I had to be brought to the polyclinic and had my chin stitched up with blood on my uniform and sent home. My mother was so apologetic to the teachers for me causing trouble for them. But that was that era. Today, I think the expectations and the partnership is quite different. I think today, on a positive side, most parents are prepared and want to be more involved. And that's why today, when we have parent support group, many parents will genuinely want to come and partner the schools to work with the schools to come up with programs that are suitable for their students. But on the other hand, you will naturally have a minority of parents that do not know the boundaries or expect too much from this partnership. And that's why I say that it is a partnership. It is not a service client mindset where I expect this and you deliver to me. Because no matter what we do in schools, it's only that many hours. 8 hours, 10 hours, whatever it might be. The larger part of time is with the families. And someone reminded me recently that we, as parents, we are all the first teachers of our children. And that partnership must continue. So this is where I think over time we need to set those expectations on what is right and wrong. And we want fellow parents to understand, if we are unreasonable in our demands for a teacher, actually, we are unfair to the rest of the students and unfair to the rest of the parents, because you are depriving the teacher from spending quality time with the rest of the students who also have their needs. And that's why in handling such very difficult parents, we tend at the MOE level to try and have extra resources at the MOE level to shield the school and the teachers from this direct impact. Otherwise, the teacher is left to handle this. It's very unfair for the teacher, not good for their work-life balance, mental health, and not good for the rest of the students and the rest of the parents. But when you have very positive stories and more of them are coming through the parent support group, then you can see that the teachers in turn are stay encouraged. They know that they are not in this journey. Today, just to bring up our own children is already difficult enough. What more about bringing up children of many other families with such diverse needs? And we want to see that partnership. And I think we are making progress to build this partnership. There will always be some negativity, but I think we don't want to let that distract our teachers and parents from the vast majority who wants to build a positive relationship. And it's quite interesting. Many of the new towns like Punggol, where the parents are younger, you see very strong parent support groups whose parents, maybe because of also their work routine, they are much more involved in the schools. They come to schools to run what we call counselling programs, as in what we call ESG programs, to guide the students on their choice of career. They run programs like reading programs and so forth. So I think these are the positive examples. But I must admit that every one negative example takes a disproportionate amount of time from the school leaders and also MOE. I have always joked that one day maybe I should publish one of these, some of these infamous letters and demands from some of these parents. So I thought, better don't do this. Lest it normalize such behaviors. And I think that's the key thing. We don't want to normalize such behavior. We want to affirm the positive and contain the negative.
You mentioned that MOE steps in, you know, to show the teachers. Is it like a SOP? I mean, can teachers expect that kind of support every time they need to deliver?
So we have an escalation protocol. Usually, I will want the teachers and the school leaders to be able to manage it, because it's important for them to respect the school's authority and to respect the decisions. Because if we keep allowing people to escalate the thing and bypass the school, they will totally they will not respect the school anymore, and they will keep thinking they will go to the minister. If the minister cannot, they will go to the prime minister. Prime minister cannot, they will go to anywhere else, that even the media and so forth. And you, I mean, from the media, you know that sometimes people send you all kinds of stories to try and use your to either pressure MOE and so on and so forth. And sometimes behind the scene, we have to tell you the real story, but we can't go and say this story publicly because for the interest of the child. I mean, I have cases whereby the parents were so unreasonable that I felt so tempted that I will go and expose your whole story. But I always consider what will happen to the child if we ever do this. That's why we have always held back on this. So there's a protocol. And there is a care team. And on top of that, some of the very vexatious cases, we have dedicated teams in MOE to try and manage this so that we don't end up, because it's not fair. Not every school is going to be equipped to handle lawyer letters, police reports and things like that. So there are instances whereby MOE or even at the cluster level, we will step in to help the schools to make sure that we don't deprive the rest of the students and the parents from what they rightfully should have, because there is this one parent that distracts the rest of us from our core mission to help the rest of the students. So there is a protocol for such things.
I think there's a sense among some teachers that they are afraid that the school leaders don't back them up, I think, in some cases.
I think by now, all my teachers will know my policy on this, and they have heard me spoken about this, and I think they can be confident that we'll be here to back them up. Now, having said that, to be fair, of course, once in a while, our teacher may not be perfect, and we have to counsel our teacher to improve. But on the other hand, I would say most of the time, I have faith and confidence. Vast majority of the time, I will have faith and confidence in how my teachers handle this. And I think we need to role model for our children. So I give you one simple example. There was one group of parents that came to my Meet the People session to badger me to rescore their children's exam. So I say, okay, there is a process. You want to rescore the exam, there is a process. It's a transparent process by another group of teachers that will rescore the exam. Then I told them that, but I'm not in charge of your final score because it depends on the rescoring. And if you want to rescore, you must accept the rescored papers. Then they look at me and say that it means that it will stay the same and go up, right? So I look at them and say, actually, I don't know, because you are not asking me as the minister to rescore your paper, right? I have not seen the paper and I'm not going to see the paper. I will leave it to my teachers to do it professionally because there's a process. It can go up, it can stay the same, or it may go down. And then they look at me like, how can this be? And I was like, well, this is the process. So I'm happy to rescore the paper if you demand. But what was a bit more troubling for me in this episode was this. Before they left me, I asked them a simple question. I said, do your children know that you're coming to see the minister to ask for your exam paper to be rescored? I don't think they were very happy with me for asking this question. But I genuinely worry not about the score. I genuinely worry about what the children will learn from this whole episode. When I stumble, somebody will bail me out, or somebody will be blamed and be responsible. Or is it that even to the best of my ability, if I stumble, I will pick myself up and I will try again? I think there are things that we want our children to learn. Of course, we want a fair, transparent, accountable system. No doubt about that. But sometimes whenever our children stumble and we are too quick to demand rectification solutions, sometimes I just think that we may not be role modeling them the correct values and attitudes in life. Because I'm just wondering, in the minds of the child, he or she may feel that he has been unfairly scored. But for he or she to know that the parents will go and demand this from MOE or the minister even, I think it sends a different message to what the child will remember and bring home. And I'm not sure that is always positive.
I wanted to talk a bit about, I think actually we touched a little bit on, you know, like how our system doesn't discriminate. I think, you know, people with more and people with less can all benefit, right? One thing that always comes up when we talk about elitism and equality, equity in schools, is the alumni system, right? Would you agree that having an alumni system in terms of admitting kids to primary school and so on, does that contribute to the elitist mindset?
Okay, I make a difference between elitism and alumni system. Elitism can happen in alumni and non-alumni system. So it's like someone from one of these popular schools say that, the students say that. People say that I'm in this popular school and this elite school, so they call me elitist. Minister, do you think it's fair? So I asked him, yes, people call you and say that you are from an elite school, but are you elitist? That depends on you. You know you are from a privileged school or a popular school. Do you reach out? Because your actions determine whether you should be called the elitist or not. Even if you are in the so-called top school, popular school, but if you make a conscious effort to reach out and to prove your naysayers wrong, then you have every right to tell them that you are not elitist. Because elitist to me means that you look down on the rest, you don't mix with the rest, you don't make an effort to be inclusive and appreciate and understand and respect the diversity. Then you are an elitist. So that to me, elitism is something that we want to guard against, whether you are from this school or that school, alumni school or not alumni school, it applies equally. In Singapore, we pride ourselves that we want to be an egalitarian or more egalitarian society. It may never be fully equal, but we strive because that's our ethos. We want everyone to know that so long as you are born in Singapore, you may not have the equal chance, and there may never be a situation where everybody has an equal chance to succeed, but you will have the best chance. Regardless of your background, to be born in Singapore, you will have the best chance to succeed. So someone actually asked me this, do you practice affirmative action? I say, if you think about it, we practice affirmative action in inputs. We don't practice affirmative action in outcomes. We will never be able to determine the outcome artificially by jigging the numbers, and that's not fair. But we do want to give more resources and more help to those more in need. But that also requires for those who are more privileged to accept that actually more resources will be going to those who need more help. But if everybody believes that I'm the more in need, then we are back to square one. But this is quite common. Everybody has needs. undeniably so. But that doesn't mean that everybody has equal needs, and we as a society must then help those who say that they need a bit more help. So Sandy, I have an interesting idea that I toy with some of my students' parents. I say that, you know, would you all be prepared to say that we give some priority to the students from the Comlink families? These are the most challenging families, to the students amidst us in our school's registration. And you get very interesting answers. I don't know what your answers will be, but it's an interesting idea, right? That if we so believe that we want to help this, then we should do more to help this. But when it comes to the crunch, sad to say, some of the people from the so-called popular schools will say that may not be. But of course, some of the other higher need schools will say, yeah, why not? We already take. Yeah. But you know, this really goes to the ethos of us as a people. Do we genuinely believe that we should do more to help those with less? If we genuinely believe this, then actually there are certain things that we can do more. But it doesn't mean that it is cost-free. It doesn't mean that we all don't have to share the load. It just means that we all have to do a bit more. So this, then I come to the alumni school. The alumni school has a certain history. The good part of it was that they believe, and it's valid, that if you have a certain environment and certain children will thrive in certain environment, if you give them that, provide them with a certain continuity, I think there's merit to that. Whether is it in building the local community, the school spirit, and I think those are okay. But the alumni system cannot be to the detriment of the cohesion of a society where you start forming, never mind elite or not elite, forming what I call close communities. Then that doesn't do good for that school and its community, and it doesn't do good for the country. In the past, when we were relatively younger as a nation, where our communities were not so established, there is a stronger argument to say that we use such mechanisms to build up the community spirit, the school spirit. And even until today, to a certain extent, that remains valid. However, we must not go overboard, and we must need to judge to what extent where the society has gone too far, where certain communities are now becoming closed communities. They are no longer sharing their networks and resources. And everybody, in turn, perversely use these mechanisms to try and pass down privileges and benefits. That's where our egalitarian ethos comes in and say that this is inimical to what we believe in. And that's why we try to find a balance. That's why even in the P1 registration system, we have made adjustments. In the past, I think nobody complains about the alumni system because there's not very much alumni system to complain about because we were all relatively new and perhaps younger as a nation, and we didn't have this fear that our society fractured because different social circles are being formed to the exclusion of others. But as society evolves, then we have to make some adjustment, not to throw everything out, but to find that balance. And this is where we say that, well, every school must always be open and accessible to a certain number of students. And what is that correct balance? We will have to evolve over time. We started with 20 places in every primary school, and now we have 40. Now 40, minus, if you minus off all those with siblings and the connections, that's usually a typical school taking about, say, 200 plus students, a typical school. After you take in the siblings, maybe you are with 100 plus students, and then 40 out of that could be about a third or a half, depending on the rest of the... So I think it's not a one-size-fits-all. We are not ideological in one way or the other. We just want to be practical to keep our society open and accessible for different with different backgrounds. But it's not so easy because across the world, across history, people with means will cluster themselves around certain locations, and then the school and the environment becomes more gentrified. Now that is something that we always have to lean against the forces of human nature. I was in the US. I saw this with my eyes. There was one school that was out in a place that's very far away. Nobody wanted to go there. Then the poor immigrants all went to this school. And in no time, the poor, hungry, driven immigrants raised the standard of the school. When the standard of the school was raised, all the rich people wanted to flock there. And after a while, the whole community becomes gentrified. And the immigrants can no longer go there. And then now that school is known as the elite popular school. Such things happen in other countries across history, and Singapore, we are not immune to this. Then the question is how to keep our system open and inclusive so that people mix around with different backgrounds. Now, it's not good for us to have schools where there are only Singaporeans and then all the foreign students end up in certain other schools. Actually, the foreign students here can enrich the learning of our students. You look at a school like Newtown, they have many foreign students. Their children learn to interact and grow up with people from different backgrounds. But we also have schools whereby they're all Singaporeans, maybe some PRs. I think they lose something in that process. And then we have to ask ourselves the difficult question, is there a better way for us to ensure that all our learning environment expose our students to people from different backgrounds and not have this more closed and exclusivist mindset where we are all of one kind, we all go together to the same school. And in future, chances are that I will mix with people of my background. I don't think that is good for our nation.
So in that vein, I mean, some time back, ACSI announced that it's going to move to Tengah. You know, can we expect more so-called elite schools to be relocated to provide greater accessibility?
So from what I said, I gave credit to the ACS board and the church for saying that I'm prepared to move to serve a different community. Because the real value add is not whether you produce good or bad results. The real value add is depending on the results or the quality of the students and their background that you take in, are you able to value add? So I look forward to ACS with its illustrious alumni and community to be able to value add to perhaps people not even from their background. Will there be other schools who want to undertake this challenge? I welcome them to do so, to serve communities beyond themselves. But I can't be moving schools around like that every day. But there's another thing that I think we can do. Again, no, even ACS Barker in this school. The ACS Barker, some of their students, teachers and alumni, come and help out in Newtown Primary. And I think that's a wonderful testimony of what you want to do to reach out. So it goes back to the elitism, not elitism. The fact that you are in the school, I don't brand you as elitist. I only look at your actions, whether you reach out. And I think many more people are coming forward to say that I may be an alumni of this so-called elite, popular, prestigious school or whatever you call it, but I'm prepared to go in to another school to help lift their standards or to contribute. I just visited Xinmin Primary School. In fact, one of my classmates is a VP admin of the school. He brought in two of my classmates, one of them is a doctor, to go to Xinmin. He was my classmates, none of them were from Xinmin. But I think this is the positive example of how we can use our networks to try to uplift more people. Because in Singapore today, it's not just about the financial resources that we need to share around. It's also about the networks, the opportunities that we give to people. So there are schools who think that they want to serve a wider or perhaps more challenging communities, and we'll be happy to work with them to do so. But on the other hand, we are also realistic that even if we move the schools around, then after a while, like the story I share, the community around itself might change, and then you have another different challenge altogether. So I think we're prepared to do that. I think the good thing for many of the schools and alumni that I've seen is that they have a true heart to want to serve and help the less. Of course, there will be a minority who are perhaps a bit more selfish and self-centered, but don't let them distract us and don't let them represent us. Instead, we look at those who are more prepared to step forward and say that I want to uplift more people, especially those not from my background. I think that is the story that we are seeing more, and I'm cheered by that kind of spirit amongst our parent support group, our alumni. So you cheer me a lot when many of these schools, they go and partner so some of the so-called less popular schools in their CCAs, in their even career talks and things like that. I think those are good testimonies of what we can achieve amongst our schools and amongst our parents and alumni groups.
Well, I think the last thing that we wanted to talk about is higher education and lifelong learning, you know, with the Skills Future, everything also, right? So I think people have been discussing, you know, like debating about the role of universities in this new economy. In your view, what is the most urgent change that Singapore universities need to take so that, you know, they can adapt to their role in the future? What do you think is the role of universities then?
Well, I always only have 6 words to challenge my schools, my universities. It's the same 6 words. At the individual level, distill, discern, discover. Because today, whether universities, and particularly universities, they have an avalanche of information, too much that they can handle. So the ability to distill real knowledge and information from the noise is important. It's a skill set. It's not content-based, it's a skill set. Discern, must be able to apply values to what you see, make judgment. So again, it's not about answering questions, solving problems, making judgment with values, with the right values, hopefully. And discover, okay? Because it's not enough to answer yesterday's question with yesterday's answers. I want every student, particularly in our universities, who are the more academically able in their cohort, to know that their value proposition is not just to score in what I call known tests. It is to create new value propositions, new discovery. You discover something new, you see something new, you have a new perspective, that's where you value add. And that goes to the other three things which I always ask them to do: create, collaborate, and contribute. Create is a continuum of the discovery process. Create something new, create a new value proposition. Never take for granted that people owe us a living or people should deal with us on the basis of sympathy and charity. We need to create value propositions for people to want to work with us. We need to collaborate because as the world becomes more fragmented, there is a value add to people like us who can straddle different cultures, different backgrounds, bring people with different persuasions to come to. And a subtext of that is bilingualism and multilingualism. It's not about language, it's about the deep cultural understanding that we want to have in order to understand the nuance and to bring people from different backgrounds and persuasions together. So we must never lose that. Finally, to contribute, especially to our universities, I want them to know that you are the privileged group, you are the more able group, and it's important for you to contribute. Not just what we can provide for you, but what you will do in return to provide for a better environment for the future. So I'm cheered by some of the initiatives like NUS, the Teach SG, where every undergrad will say that I'll take on the role to partner a less privileged child, because I will probably have more undergrads than less privileged child. And these are children in the schools. Not just to go there and do a few hours of tuition and whatnot, or I want them to role model. I want them to walk through the dark valleys of life with them. I want them to say that beyond the few hours I need, I build a relationship with you because I want to role model for you what is achievable. So these are things that cheer me on. So distill, discern, discover, create, collaborate, and contribute. And I want them to know that whatever you learn from the university or IHLs, for the matter, Institute of Higher Learning, Polytechnics, IT, that is but the foundation. It's not the be-all and end-all. The real success is how long you keep learning, how much more you keep learning. So in NUS, NTU, and other universities, I have a very interesting matrix that I ask them to start tracking. How many of them will return to the university or polytechnics or IT to learn something? And you can almost see a curve. I mean, recently we talked about all the PIAAC scores, about the obsolescence, the atrophy effect, and so on and so forth. But we can change that. And if anybody can do it, Singapore can, because we are better organized or we are more closely knitted, and we can do that. And if we must understand the competition not within Singapore and among Singaporeans is really how we as a workforce compared to the rest of the world. Do we keep learning? And I think we are seeing the momentum grow. On the skills future part, more and more people are taking up courses. But it's not just the numbers. We are not chasing the numbers. More and more people are taking courses that are relevant to their jobs. That means they are learning skills that will make them more marketable, more relevant to the market. And so we are cheered by this. So you look at even NUS today, both NUS and NTU, I think they graduate as many, if not even more students in the postgrad than the undergrad. Of course, many of them, or some of them might be foreign students, may not be all Singaporean students, but even amongst the Singaporean students, you can see the rising trend whereby they are not necessarily going for another degree or diploma. Many of them come back for what we call just-in-time modules. So SUSS has many of these just-in-time modules whereby people just come back and learn something. And whether it stack towards an eventual diploma or degree is not their uppermost concern. It is what is relevant to them at that point in time. But the interesting thing in this process is that we also then challenge our university and ask ourselves, how do we maintain relevance? Because if you want your student to say, I come back and do another module, they're not going to come back and do the module that they have already done many years ago, right? So that also keeps our university on their toes. So that when you say the CET, which is what we call continuing education and training, actually that is a real exit test of whether your modules are relevant. If adults in their working life say that I'm prepared to spend the financial resources, commit the time to come back to learn something from you, it must say something about the kind of courses that you are doing, right? So my joke to all the IHLs, the Institute of Higher Learning, is this. We have continuing education and training called CET. We have pre-employment education and training called PET. I say, can you CET the PET, but don't PET the CET? That means that can you keep your things current, and if you keep your CET current, then you filter it to your PET, which then makes your industry and academia loop tightened so that our people are learning the latest. But you don't go and take your PET modules and try and pass it on to your adult educators because, adult learners, because nobody will come and learn from this. So that's why the mantra is, please CET or PET, but don't PET or CET. That's the in-house joke in a MOE.
So in terms of continuous learning, I mean, do you see that the big pieces are mainly in place? Or are there some parts that we're still missing?
There are a lot of things that we want to do, many more things we want to do. Okay, so this is a laundry list of things that we want to do. First, I think we are not done shifting the mindset. We still need our people to truly embrace lifelong learning, and sometimes not just for economic value. Of course, economic relevance is important. So first, I think the mindset needs to change. Number two, I think beyond the individual, the industry mindset also need to change. We cannot just keep looking for people. We need to grow our timber, and we need to train our own workforce. Never be afraid to poach them. One of the very enlightened employers say this, yes, when I train my employee, I'm afraid that they are being poached. But I'm even more afraid if nobody wants to poach my employee, which means that they are not so relevant. So I think that's three. I think our institutions also need to evolve and keep making sure that we are at the cutting edge of frontier technology by partnering industries and so forth. Then another thing that our institutions need to do is that forget about this phrase called going back to school. Nobody's going to go back to school. But how can we make our modules much more digestible, accessible for even people who don't necessarily come back and learn? They only come back for the discussion, for the group work. But can we make modules more accessible? So in extremis, we even have this joke about TikTok and TeachTok. You know that TikTok is now quite popular. I say, you know, TeachTok. What is TeachTok? TeachTok is, can you learn something in 1 minute? Can you explain something in 30 seconds, you know, in a fun and entertaining way? But actually, a lot of education resources are actually available in some of these modules down there. How do we challenge ourselves to make our modules much more accessible and affordable to the vast majority without them having to come back to school necessarily? So I think these are things that we want to do, right? Then finally, there's one other thing beyond the individual industry and institutions. One final thing that we need to do, the fourth thing, is what I call the research on adult pedagogies. How do adults learn? We have NIE to go very deeply into the science of learning for school children. We have NIEC that goes very deep into the science of early childhood development and how we build up the social-emotional foundations for our children. But in the whole world today, what is most lacking is the science of adult learning. Because an adult learning the same content at 25, 35, 45, 55, learn it in different ways. Their brains are wired up in different ways. The background experiences are different. So we need to better understand the science of learning, which is why I want the Institute of Adult Learning with SUSS to become the third limb of our tripods, if you like. We have NIE, we have NIEC, we would like IAL to be the third limb of this tripods or trident. Right? Because then we can... And there are many interesting and exciting technologies in adult learning world. So, for example, today, we have AI programs that can generate a training plan for an adult according to their needs in 45 minutes. In the past, it would take a long time to do lesson plan for adults and to do customization. So what we talk about, mass customizations for the children, actually, to be frank, the children part is the easier one. The even more difficult part is the mass customization for the adults. Children, there are maybe 10, 15 cohorts, relatively homogeneous. My adults are 40, 50 years cohort, and they are much more heterogeneous. And that is where the AI, the power of AI, the mass customizations needs to come in even more impactfully. And that is what we are working on. So those are the things that I think we prioritize in terms of building the adult ecosystem. But of course, together with MOM, they're also working on how you recognize the skill sets. We even talk to companies like LinkedIn and whatnot to understand how do you sense make what are the emerging skill sets that are needed so that you can package the skill sets quickly and then push out the modules to the adult learners. And that is still an ongoing challenge. I don't think we will ever finally arrive, but it will always be work in progress. But there's a lot of exciting things about how people learn in their adult years and how we can use the latest AI technology, data science and learning science to complement the design of our curriculum and access for them.